Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're back at the races, a little less than 10 minutes toward the top of the hour, and we'll get some John White thoughts in later this morning as well. I think get an opportunity to have Darren Rogers visit, and we'll also continue to pay tribute to Cott Campbell. We're going to do that now with Jack Sadler joining us. And Jack's association really goes the breadth of Dogwood's presence in and around the game. And certainly, you know, we had the visit from Neil Howard to start things off. And Neil, you know, goes back to near the beginning, but Jack was there virtually from the start. And Jack, for horse players and fans and industry stakeholders, extend our sincerest condolences to Ann and to you and everybody in the Dogwood family.
Thank you so much, and I'm very glad and honored to be with you this morning. My association with Cott, I graduated on a Thursday from Washington and Lee University in 1976. And the following Tuesday, I reported to Pimlico Racetrack as a hot walker. And shortly thereafter, when I was climbing the ladder to be a groom, I had a filly under my care named Muna's Dust in 1976, owned by Dogwood Stable. And that was really the birth of a relationship that has spanned 42 years. And 42 great years,
Jack. On that note, and with that in mind, talk about those early days and you know, the way in which things began to meld and form, and you know what Cott's thoughts were, and how you know this entire process, you know, the origins, because it obviously changed the entire industry.
It did, yes. As I said, I first met Cott in 1976, and Frank Alexander became a private trainer for him. And then in 1980, Cott offered me a position at Dogwood Farm in Georgia. And he told me, you'll love it down here. It never gets below 50 degrees. So he was known to stretch the truth a little bit at times. But he really, you know, over the years, he's always been referred to as the father of the partnership approach. And as he always said, that he bought a filly in 1969 and got a couple of friends in Atlanta involved with him, and then bought another horse and then a third and got some people involved and thought, you know, there might be something to this. And he's always said that he went to Lexington to talk to people about it and was told, oh, no, that won't work in this industry. And what he would do is he would not be denied. And he and Ann was his greatest supporter. Would have bought a farm, land in a farm in Georgia, in Greenville, Georgia, and opened up two training barns, and we'd have breezing shows. People would come down on Saturday to see horses that Cott had purchased and wanted to form partnerships. And so the people would come down and eat and see the horses breeze, and that played a big role in the development of Dogwood Stable. And as it grew, in 1986, Cott actually sold the farm and moved the operation to here in Aiken, South Carolina. And the horses came over in Aiken in 1986, and then Cott and Ann followed the following year and set up the office here, bought a home, and refurbished it as an office. And so we've been here, you know, since that time and had some great experiences. Cott embraced Aiken, and Aiken embraced him right off the bat. And he always wanted to share the horses with the people of Aiken and the fans of Dogwood Stable. When we had Summer Squall, Storm Song, and Palace Malice, they would have breaks even after their classic success, come back to Aiken, and we'd have people come out in the afternoon to watch them graze. And I'll never forget the Saturday before Palace Malice left here for the last time, we had over 500 people come out to the track, and the fog was so thick you could not see 20 feet in front of you, but they all still showed up. And so this has been our base. And is it the partnerships? You know, always people have said that Cott's been known as the father of partnerships, and that's so true. When I first came into the office in 1990, there really weren't that many out there. And now, as you know, I guess you look at the overnight at Churchill Downs, and 70% of the horses racing on Wednesday this week will be owned by partnerships. And it's not only racing partnerships, but now we're even seeing more and more partnerships being formed as horses enter the sales ring at the Fasig Tipton and Keeneland and OBS and wherever.
Jack, you can speak even more, I think, to the power of and the winning nature of Cott's personality. You know, he was an ad man. You talked about, you know, the friends and business and associates and colleagues that he brought in from his days in Atlanta. He had that infectious and kind of irrepressible personality, you know, and it wasn't the kind that was always selling either. It wasn't a question of him, you know, on the hustle ever. It was one of those personalities that people are really drawn to, and you know, he and Ann, their presence as kind of a Dutch uncle and aunt for people interested in the sport, really it really, you know, became a kind of an institution.
Like you say, both he and Ann are people persons, and they just love, as I said, not really selling horses, but selling the sport of horse racing. And he would always enjoy just talking horses with people. He didn't look at it, well, is this person somebody who could be a client of mine that I could sell a horse to? That's not the way he approached it. Again, it was just a social aspect of it. and trying to spread his love of horse racing and drawing as many people into the industry as he could. And obviously through the partnership approach, people who maybe wouldn't otherwise were able to. And he, just a wide range of people, and I've always said that there are a lot of people that approached Cott and they wanted to get involved in racing. They'd had some success in their line of business and had some discretionary funds, but they wanted to do it as a sport and hobby and didn't want to have to deal with a day-to-day management of it, which is the role that Cott played. And so for me personally, Cott just opened so many doors, and I have been able to develop so many relationships from people of all walks of life.
And yeah, Jack, the interesting aspect of it is that as you mentioned, when you said Lexington, the initial reaction was not positive per se or welcoming. He had to kind of doggedly, continuing to pursue, the concept. And I suppose Summer Squall, for all intents and purposes, really winning a classic, had to kind of guarantee the future for the entire operation and the concept itself. And I'd also love you to fold in, the fact that his father, who introduced him to the game, actually, lost everything when it came to his involvement in horses. And I can only imagine that, that had to weigh slightly on Cott in some manner up to a certain point the success of and the future was assured.
His dad did introduce him to it. His dad was with Coca-Cola and bought land and developed a farm in Tennessee right before the war. And so he had all these horses down there, and he couldn't move them because of gas rationing and all. And so that venture did not turn out. It wasn't the only venture Mr. Campbell undertook that didn't turn out, but he always bounced back. And I was fortunate enough to get to know him for a while when we were at Dogwood Farm. But he is the one, I think, that instilled the love of horses and horse racing into Cott. And actually, just last week, Cott gave me a program of the Aiken Trials one year, and it was the year that Kelso came to Aiken, was training here in Aiken. And Kelso was one of Cott's all-time favorite horses. Now, of course, he also had a liking for Dominion, who was really the horse, I think, that put Dogwood Stable on the map. Cott bought him in England and brought him over here. But, yes, as you mentioned, I think Summer Squall was the key horse. When he won the Preakness in 1990, the phone started ringing off the hook for people who wanted to get involved in partnerships. And it just grew from there, not only for Dogwood, but for other outfits around the country. That's when you began to see more and more partnership outfits appear. And so Cott's been known as the father of partnerships, the two-legged variety, but I would say that Summer Squall probably did play a big role in the growth of the partnership industry also.
There's other aspects too that and Aaron Wellman will join us tomorrow when he gets here to Louisville. There's an aspect of Cott that is constantly part of any description of him as an individual and as an industry stakeholder, stalwart, and that is integrity to a fault, and loyalty too. His loyalty to trainers. There's a parallel track, obviously, to some of the successes, including early identification of Todd Pletcher as somebody to send horses to. And that, you know, that is obviously to the lasting credit of Cott and his legacy, because it led ultimately to Palace Malice, one of the earliest horses of Todd's career. Trippy, right, was a Todd Pletcher Dogwood runner.
I remember, Steve, standing in the racing office at Saratoga one afternoon. It was Todd Pletcher and myself, and Todd turned around to Cott and said, "Mr. Campbell, I'm going to start my own training operation this winter down at Hialeah, and I really would appreciate your support." And without hesitation, right away I knew Cott was going to send horses to Todd.
Wow.
So actually he was, Dogwood was one of his original owners, and it just grew from there. Trippy was a horse that Todd had. The story with Trippy actually was not the greatest moving horse, and I always said that Todd trained him in the dark so that when he talked to Mr. Campbell, he could say, "Yeah, he looked great this morning from what I could see." And I also remember, though, Todd calling me up one morning and said, "Jack, I've got good news, bad news, and good news." This was in late November, early December. Said, "Trippy bucked his shins this morning. That's the disappointing news. But the good news is now I can wait until Gulfstream, where the purses are better, before I run him." And so, of course, he did win his first five starts. Mm-hmm. And ran in the Kentucky Derby. And then he ran in the Woody Stevens, I want to say, won that. And we kept him as a sprinter from there on.
Trippy, as it happens, not to dwell on him, but I will make the point that I've said this, Jack, regarding Todd in particular. He's a poster horse, you know, for the people who say, "Oh, that Todd hasn't won enough Kentucky Derbies." The fact that Todd got a horse like Trippy to the Derby, it tells you a lot about him and the fact that he was able to even get the horse there. And this was a horse that had never had any intention of winning at a mile and a quarter. And Todd had a lot of those horses. And, you know, he also had a lot of those that, you know, that ran very well in Derbies. Whether they were Dogwood or not. I'm glad we stopped on Trippy for a second, because, you know, as soon as he was turned back to what he was meant to do, one turn, he cleaned up. So that was a perfect example.
He finished third in the Kentucky Derby. Impeachment broke his maiden down in Calder in his first start. Never won another race again, but he finished third in the Derby, and he finished third in the Preakness, and then I want to say it was the fifth in the Belmont, behind the Lewis's horse Commendable. But just like I say, with Todd and the Kentucky Derby, you know, it's everybody's dream to run in the Kentucky Derby, and while there are horses such as Trippy, that the mile and a quarter was not the distance for them. But
yep,
of all of the horses that Todd has trained into the race, they've all earned their ticket and deserve to be in the starting gate on that day.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then, of course, to have the crazy adventure, the way it turned out regarding Palace Malice. And it was really after Palace Malice that the Dogwood brand melds with Eclipse Thoroughbred Partners. But that, I suppose, to a degree, other than getting into the Hall of Fame as a pillar of the turf this summer, that's a pretty indelible moment, I think, for the the Cott Campbell Dogwood era.
That Belmont Day was very special because Cotton Ann and all of the partners of Alice Malice were there, of course. And Todd was, I'll never forget, it was in about three boxes in front of Cotton Ann. And as soon as Palace Malice hit the wire, Todd did the fist pumps he's known for, immediately turned around, ran up to Ann Campbell, and threw his arms around her. And to see that was one of the greatest thrills that I've had in racing. Mm-hmm. And just being able to say, Todd, you told me that this horse was going to win a big race, and just congratulations. And so that was definitely one of our highlights. Mm-hmm.
Jack Sadler with us, and Jack, 40-plus years with Cott Campbell at Dogwood. Cott, I said to Neil Howard, he'll be with us always, Jack, the influence. And you know, the for those that have not read his writing, I cannot suggest any of the books enough, because he was a wonderful writer and incredibly evocative. His writing, you literally, as you read anything he wrote, you can hear him saying it, which is special. I can't push it enough.
He wrote his books here in the office, and he would make a poster of Skull and Crossbones and tape it to his door. And so if you walked by, the door was closed and the Skull and Crossbones were there, it meant, don't bother me, I'm writing. And also, but he was just such a true gentleman, too. And this has meant so much to myself and my family. You know, the truth is, I wouldn't be where I am today without him. No way possible. And even though he announced his retirement in November of 2011, he still kind of came into the office every day, even up to last week. Now, he didn't come in Saturday and Sunday as much as he used to, but we'd always see him here. And the relationship he developed with Aaron Wellman, as you mentioned, and Eclipse, has just been a blessing to us. When he announced his retirement, even though we still had 50 horses partnerships running, they worked it out. Aaron was happy to let me stay here and help Cott run those partnerships. And Bill Victor, our chief financial officer, and I will stay here in Aiken in this office. And so Cott wanted to make sure that Bill and I landed on our feet when he announced his retirement, and we're forever grateful for that.
No, Jack, I'm grateful for this visit, and the arrangements now have been finalized Thursday, I believe.
Yes, there'll be a service here in Aiken on Thursday at 2 o'clock, and then a reception, actually in the infield of the training track here in Aiken.
Oh, nice.
Following that at about 3:00, and I believe also, Steve, are going to have a celebration of life service up at Saratoga during the meet at some point also.
Mm-hmm. Outstanding.
We've heard from so many people, and you know, there's so many people that want to honor him, and obviously with the Breeders' Cup and all, people have other, you know, all kinds of obligations to try to fulfill. And so with that in mind, there'll be a celebration up at Saratoga also.
Excellent. Jack, is there, I haven't seen it in an obituary. Is there a charity that Cott would want race fans and horse players to contribute in his memory?
There is, gosh. I mean, I'm sorry here. I've got.
It's all right.
It's the Racetrack Chaplaincy Program.
Okay.
Is what they would like in lieu of flowers. That's what the request has been. Mm-hmm.
Terrific. Because,
as you know, they've both Cotton and Ann have been huge supporters of that. And so that is what they've indicated.
Very nice. I'll put that link up so people the chaplaincy does wonderful work, and COD has spoken at their luncheon. In fact, they've got their White Horse Awards this week, I believe Thursday, and that's a wonderful choice as well, and of course there isn't probably anybody in the around the game that hasn't been to some function, whether it was a symposium, University of Arizona, or any gathering. COT was always sought out, and was always a fabulous speaker that really inspired people and encouraged their participation in the game for all the right reasons. Jack Sadler, sincerest sympathies to everybody at Dogwood, to Ann and their daughters, and I appreciate this very much.
Well, thank you, and we thank all of you who have reached out over the last couple of days. It's been a tough time, but we are all soldiering on, and that is what COD always wanted us to do.
No doubt. Lightning in a Jar, Catching Racing Fever was the first book. That's the one that I read years ago, and then came back with Memoirs of a Long Shot, A Riprarious mm-hmm. Life. And then Rascals and Racehorses, most recently, and all are wonderful reads. And if you didn't know Cot Campbell, you will after reading any and all of those. Jack Sadler, best wishes.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it, Steve.
Not at all. Jack Sadler joining us from Aiken, and everybody at Aiken will turn out undoubtedly for Thursday for services and then the gathering at the training track. It's funny, we've been down to Aiken a couple of times these last few weeks with Gory Smith, and now with this visit from Jack Sadler. I really appreciate Jack joining us. Let's take a break. We got plenty to do yet, about 40 minutes worth of show, and Todd can't join us today. He's tied up, but we certainly will get Todd, and you got a real window into that relationship, the Cot Campbell, you know, helping Todd right at the beginning. And you know, there's a handful of clients that Todd has had literally from the day he hung the shingle, Scatorchio's as well, of course, and others. But Dogwood was right there at the beginning. We'll take a break. Lots yet to do. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Don't wait. With 14 challenging Breeders' Cup races, 5 Friday, November 2nd, and 9 Saturday, November 3rd, you've got to be ready. Kickstart your handicapping mojo with ExpressBet's free Breeders' Cup wager guide, available online at expressbet.com beginning Friday, October 26th. Get analysis, selections, price plays, and $100 wagering strategies for every Breeders' Cup race from expert handicappers and broadcasters, plus plenty of stats and trends you won't find anywhere else. XBTV's Jeff Siegel, At the Races radio host Steve Vick, NBC Sports analyst Nick Luck, and multiple Eclipse Award winner Dick Girardi anchor a powerful team of guide experts. NBC Sports analyst Eddie Olchek and retired sportscaster Brent Musburger of VSiN will contribute to a revised guide version available Thursday, November 1st. Go to expressbet.com now, open an account, and get the free guide and play Breeders' Cup.
Account wagering is not permitted in all states. National Problem Gambling Support Line, 1-800-522-4700.
There's more good news about Pennsylvania's breeding program. Last year, the number of state-bred live foals rose by nearly 30%. Many other states saw a drop of between 10 and 20%. This says that Pennsylvania truly has North America's fastest-growing and most lucrative breeding program. And unlike some other states, our Racehorse Development Fund can only be used to support Pennsylvania breeding and racing. This is Brian Sanfratello. Please visit us at PABred.com.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing, this is At the Races with Steve Dick on Sirius XM Radio.
When you touch my hand and talk sweet talk, I got a knocking in my knees and a wobble in my walk. I'm trembling and I'm shaking. And when you take me in your arms to talk romance, my heart starts dough and a stink bodies dance. And I'm panting and I'm shaking.
We're back at the races. Little Willie John joining us. And Big D.
I love this music.
Thank you.
This is great. You and I have very similar eclectic tastes.
Yeah, well, you like everything. You're
Casey's the man. You know, he's always got good music.
The season kicked off here yesterday.
How about it?
And I think people kind of overlooked the fact that, you know, there's the Churchill Fall Meet started yesterday, a 2-year-old card to get things going, and it was a great way to start.
Here's a rarity. You know, and by the way, we kicked off Sunday, and we'll be racing Wednesday through Sunday through Thanksgiving weekend. But Jim Gluckson of Breeders' Cup was telling me he believes this is the first Breeders' Cup venue that they've been to since it was last here in 2011, that there's actually racing on Wednesday at the track. See, he's kind of excited about how that'll, you know, spice up the week, but all the other previous hosts had been dark on Wednesdays. Del Mar, he said Keeneland, and, you know, a couple of the others.
Interesting.
You know, Santa Anita, they were racing Thursday through Sunday. So,
interesting.
Anyway, that just a little sidebar nugget, but yeah, we're racing Wednesday through Sunday through Thanksgiving weekend, and tremendously excited about the prospects of this fall meet. Not only are we, you know, delighted that the Breeders' Cup's returning for the first time after a 7-year hiatus, it's so great to have these horses on the grounds of this caliber. You know, we get to see it. We get excited every year at Oaks and Derby, but you know, the 221 pre-entries, you're probably, you know, entries were due today at 10 a.m. Like the pre-entry record, probably going to get an entry record of somewhere in the neighborhood of 175 to 180 horses. And just watching them train in the morning of this caliber, it's very exciting. But this entire fall meet is exciting because in mid-December, you know, we opened up nearby Derby City Gaming, which has the state-of-the-art historical racing machines. This is something that could produce, you know, somewhere up to $15 to $20 million annually. And we're already seeing the benefits of it opening in mid-September. Our prize money this fall, take out the two Breeders' Cup days. You know, I could throw those in and,
yeah,
and overinflate numbers, but that's not realistic. Take out the two Breeders' Cup days. Our average daily purses will be nearly $650,000. Maiden special weights were $60,000 last fall. By the way, we raised them last fall from 52.
Right.
So 2 years ago, they were $52,000 maiden special weights. Last fall, $60,000. This year, $76,000 maiden special weights. We gave up $500,000 in prize money during the fall last year. It's a 29% increase. Kentucky Racing, it's on the come. It's the place to be. The quality that we're seeing, more horsemen are going to be following the money.
I hear Chad Brown and Todd Pletcher will both have established spring strengths.
Why wouldn't you? I mean, the allowance races right now are $78,000 to $88,000 for the allowance level. It's great to be able to, you know, fuel the prize money, give horsemen, you know, ample prize money to compete for. So excluding this Breeders' Cup, I'm really, really excited about the fall meet. And just to give you a quick example, yeah. On Sunday, you said, you know, it kind of snuck up on you. Wagering was up 7% from a year ago, and we had two less stakes. Remember, we had another division of the Spendthrift Juvenile Filly. They just went with the Colt division this year. And the Street Sense, which is typically run on, you know, Stars of Tomorrow, we moved to the Breeders' Cup undercard.
Right.
And so, you know, that's tremendously – it's a great start. It's tremendously exciting. And, you know, it's a great time of year. It's a great time of the year.
And all of this is on heels of a September meet where
– records.
The handle numbers were up.
About 15%, I think it was.
And that
shored up the circuit. You know, that September
exactly.
meet, along with the health of, you know, Kentucky Downs with their prize money and their success has helped fuel purses at Ellis Park. The Kentucky circuit from, you know, April through November is tremendous. And I think it's only going to get stronger and more appealing. And the average field size for us here, you know, people say, oh, God, that, you know, we hate those 5 and 6 horse fields
in
the spring meet.
Mess.
Those are the days of yesteryear.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, if you look, the September meet was in the neighborhood of, I think it was 8.5 horses a race. Last fall, we averaged 8.9.
Well,
I think you're going to see that number challenged with the prize money. This is a benefit for horsemen. It's a benefit for horse players. We're excited about it.
Well, and of course, you know, our broadcast week is presented by the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund, and this is a story that is a fascinating and really a circuitous tale. Because it, you know, certainly a big part of it starts with Kentucky Downs, but also with the frustrations associated with Governor Beshear and the preparations to potentially have a you know, gaming, alternative gaming in Kentucky in general. There was this slow trickle where the horses were going to Indiana, mm-hmm. West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and then Ohio, of all places, throws a hat in the ring. They looked like the last place that was going to get gaming. And then all of a sudden, they went from 0 to 60 in 2 seconds.
It wasn't that long ago.
No. And the way these dominoes fell to resurrect and to stabilize things in Kentucky, it really was fortuitous. And
when you take a look at the landscape of other jurisdictions at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, Kentucky is on the come. I think
no,
you're
going to no
see
doubt
a
about
lot
it.
Of horsemen setting up divisions here. It's no secret, you know, I don't think it's going to happen on the horizon. We have some other things, but to explore the opportunity of building new barns, we have filed paperwork within the city. And that was in the event that we decide to move forward with it quickly. We're going to walk.
Wow.
We're going to walk a little bit, but don't be surprised down the road, we may have 4 or 5 more barns built at Churchill Downs across the street from the stable gate entrance where the old racing office and the church was. Maybe that's, you know, and you'd have very Saratoga-esque with
a guard.
A
oh,
guard
that'll go
and a
over
crossway,
great.
You know.
People love that.
So anyway, we'll figure that out down the road. But again, that's not happening anytime
overnight.
Soon, but we're exploring.
How about that?
The fact that we're exploring it says a lot.
It would.
I mean, we've got 1,400 horses here, plus we have 500 over at Trackside Louisville,
right,
where the Derby City Gaming Complex is located. That's 1,900 stalls, and if you ask Steve Hargrave, there aren't enough right now, especially when we host a Breeders' Cup. It's very challenging on the racing department. I mean, they take about 200 to 300 stalls, but they do a great job at shifting. But there are more people wanting to come in. So if that's the case, let's consider options how to accommodate more horses.
In addition to all the underpinnings, there's also been some, let's say, shifting sands in terms of a improved interpersonal skills between the organization and some outlets. The TVG developments is a major. People may think, oh good. It's more than just oh good. That's a significant addition to getting back on the channel.
Yeah, the corporate office I know had always been in talks with TVG. Clearly, they've come to some agreement that was made, I believe it was a week into the September meet, and it was more of a let's take baby steps, and it was through the September meet, and we received word that we'll be on the primary channel for TVG throughout the 21-day fall meet, and that's great for horse players across the country. I mean, anytime you can get your signal on in front of more people, that's always a good thing, and we've always felt that way, but business and discussions sometimes get in the way.
Nick Luck making the appearance. Just look at it. Say a quick hello here. Hold on, let me do that.
And this is royalty. This is media
this
royalty.
This is what makes
hello, gentlemen. Good morning.
The dulcet tone.
Just swinging by, and who should I see but Mr. Steve Bick, one of the top 10 horse racing radio talk show hosts in the United States.
There's only
Fridays,
six.
3 hours
there's maybe,
a day.
There's maybe six of us. there might be seven.
Oh, it's good to be back.
What's good to have you? You've been in the U.S. more than you've been home.
More than most people would care for. Yes. No. I hear you. But no, it's nice to be back. We've had some great racing at home since I was last here. Art Weekend, of course, and then British Champions Day. So, yeah, we're all geared up to go. If the weather could be like this for the rest of the week, we'd be happy. But the forecast doesn't look quite so kind.
I'm hearing that. Tomorrow's going to be a beautiful day.
Mm-hmm.
Wednesday, we will get pelted.
Mm-hmm.
Thursday morning, it sounds like we won't. We'll be dry in the morning for training. Get some more rain, I think, Thursday afternoon, ending in the evening. And then it looks good on Friday and Saturday.
That's fine. As long as it's dry,
exactly.
I think. Exactly.
Wednesday, I think here in Louisville, there's already some discussions going around trying to get trick-or-treating and Halloween move to tomorrow night instead of Wednesday. But anyway, I'm not worried about kids and candy. But
I gather everyone's quite encouraged by the fact that the relatively new drainage system here is going to help the turf track as well, and the pump room is going to suck all the water up, rather like the greens at Augusta.
I would be surprised if it is not soft, though.
On an official going description, yeah.
Yes. I mean, more of maybe officially, it could be on the good to yielding side, but there's going to be some give in the ground. That we've had a tremendous amount of rain. We had a very dry summer. A hot summer, and it went from 80 to 50.
Yes.
We didn't have much of a fall. In fact, the leaves, you'll notice, are just starting to turn their colors.
It's been very similar in England, in truth. It's been an unusually hot summer.
But I would expect, given the ground,
hot fall, and now it's cold.
I will say that the inside path, so we have been on lane 3, mm-hmm. 22 feet out. We, of course, ran a 11-date September meet at Churchill. The spring meet ended in late June. The inside 22 feet have not been touched since June.
So there's going to be more pronounced advantage potentially to the inside.
Right, so exactly.
Which is the converse of when the Breeders' Cup was last in Kentucky in 2015 at Keeneland, when the inside was the last place you wanted to be.
It was boggy and terrible.
Famously, Golden Horn sank on the rail.
Yep.
I think for everybody, but particularly from a European point of view. And I've made this point to you before, Steve. I never really like it when there's too much rain here, because I worry that the turf tracks get a bit loose and shifty on top, a bit like it did at Monmouth in 07 when the Euros drew a blank, and a bit like Keeneland in 15. But given what I'm being told about your turf course here, it strikes me that there's still going to be integrity in the surface, even if there's a lot of rain. So it's not all going to slip off the top, and horses will be able to get footing on it. You're not as convinced as I'm.
We've had a lot of give, and again, we had a very hot summer where roots are difficult to grab hold.
Right.
Now, how that's performed since it's cooled off and we've received a lot of rain recently, are they grabbing hold? I don't know. Mm. We'll find out.
We will.
One of the other considerations, the fact that the European teams, Nick, historically have targeted the event with the anticipation that they're going to have a firmer footing, yeah, and that horses they send and deign to identify earlier in the year as candidates are in anticipation of a firmer, slicker, you know, footing and more rattle on the ground. And so that throws another wrench into the works.
It does. I would say, if just looking at the turf team as a whole, I do think it's a slightly more varied group of horses. There's so many two-year-olds as well that you can't make too many hard and fast assertions about what their ground requirements might be. You can about the older horses, but I do think it's a more varied group of horses. I mean, take the European headline act, if you like, in the turf races, Enable. She's proven herself to be pretty versatile as regards ground, and actually it's received wisdom that she wouldn't want it too quick, particularly if she had a knee injury early in the year. So anything that doesn't have too much concussion, then it's probably going to be to her advantage.
Waldgeist?
I think he's adaptable as regards surface. I don't think he's got any problem how soft or quick the ground is. I like him in the turf. I think he'll run a big race.
How do you feel about your milers this year? And I wanted to ask you about one.
This just came up, actually.
One in particular that is intrigued me. Is it Mushatri?
Mustachery.
Mustachery.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Good thing I'm not an announcer. Mm. But he looks like he's on the come. Is that a good assertion?
Well, I think the ownership were quite keen to call it a day with him after his last run, but I think Sir Michael thought that there was a big one in him, and he was a horse who had a grade one in him, and I think maybe he identified this as the right horse. I interviewed Richard Hills, the representative for Sheikh Hamdan at Newbury, when they had a stakes winner on Saturday, and he was very bullish about the horse being able to run a bold race. It's quite interesting, their stable rider is Jim Crowley, and Jim has the ride on Muntahar in the Melbourne Cup for John Gosden in those blue and white silks. And I said, well, is Jim going to do both? And they believed that it was too much of an ask for a jockey to apply himself fully to riding in a Breeders' Cup race and then go to Melbourne to ride in the Melbourne Cup. Now, Frankie Dettori's done it before and has done it to good effect.
Yeah.
But I think they wanted Jim to go down to Melbourne, get a whole week under his belt there, ride Muntahar in the Melbourne Cup. So they put William Buick to take the ride on Mustachery in the Breeders' Cup mile. So he's got plenty of experience. He's ridden Breeders' Cup winners. I think he's picked up a pretty good spare. He's a decent horse, and in a year where I think it's fair to say there isn't a standout older miler either here or in Europe, he's got to be in the mix. He's got to be in the mix.
And the unusual circumstance could prove out, too, that Shadwell will have the domestic entrant in as well, mm-hmm, in Almanar. Mm-hmm. It was just strange that they were 15 and 16 on the list. And if a Raving Beauty does commit to the girls' race, then both of Shadwell's AEs are going to participate.
Yeah, but it's the right race for both of them. So I don't see any reason why they wouldn't and why they shouldn't. And they won the race pretty recently as well, didn't they? Tamaku's won the race two years ago?
Two years ago, I think. Mm. That only goes up to the 12th.
Santa Anita, wasn't it? Yeah.
Others in here, I had, and I brought this up with you a couple of weeks ago, I had David Simcock on, and they had this circled for Lightning Spear months and months ago.
I don't think he wants the ground too soft, but although he's seven, he deserves respect. It took him 17 goes, I think, in grade ones to break his grade one duck at Goodwood, but he'd run so many good races hitting the board and was so consistent that you knew he was a bona fide grade one animal. This is his last run before he goes to stud. He'll go to Tween Hill stud, same stud we think that Roaring Lion will end up at, and he'll I think he'll give a good account of himself. You can put a line through the run at Ascot where he really didn't like the ground, and I think they knew. You know, they had Roaring Lion in that race. They ended up being forced to run both owner mates in the same race at Ascot. I don't think Lightning Spear was given a hard time. I think they had an eye on this weekend. So I wouldn't condemn him for running down the pack the other day.
And both, but you know, he'll be in the neighborhood of 15-1.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose it's a little bit of a leap of the imagination to see him winning, but it's not off the premises.
Where are you on the O'Brien trio? Gustav Klimt, I Can Fly, and Happily.
Well, they're all very different, and they're all very interesting. We take them in that order. Gustav Klimt, they've not really been sure this year what sort of a horse he is. He's by Galileo, but Aidan O'Brien's kept saying how much speed he's got. So much so that they ended up running him in a 6-furlong Group 1 in soft ground at Haydock, and he ended up running quite well and finishing third. I think this is more his bag. I think this sort of mile is right for him. He's quite a handy little horse. He's not over big, and the demands of the race should suit him quite well. I Can Fly obviously ran an absolute screamer on British Champions Day, and if you can take that literally, then that puts her into the mix, and Happily never went in the gate. That was quite controversial, because she got in the gate at Ascot. The gate, I think that the starting team thought the gate had shut behind her, and she kicked out and opened it, which means you're in automatic withdrawal now. But I'm not convinced the gate was entirely shut, and there was absolutely nothing wrong with her. So who knows, that might have been a blessing in disguise. But her form when she was second to Lawrence in the Sun Chariot, again, puts her in the mix. They're all about the same horse, essentially. You just try and find something to sort of transcend the group, and it's quite hard to do so.
The Haggis runner, one master, mm-hmm. you know, coming off the Prix de la Forêt.
Yeah, running in the race that won the race that Polly Dream was a unlucky and beaten favourite in. Polly Dream's an interesting runner, but of course everyone's seen it now. It's the worst of both worlds insofar as you like a horse for a race. She doesn't win, but she's desperately unlucky and never comes off the bridle. Unfortunately, everyone's seen it. Then she takes a load of money, so she's overbet, even though you don't really know what would have happened last time. Does that make any sense?
Yes.
So, one master won the race. I think cutting the ground is pretty crucial to her.
And that gets us...
A lot of fillies in this race.
Which is fun. We love that.
That's... And fillies have got a great record in it. Fillies have a good record at this time of year. They have a great record. They get the allowance, which no one seems to make anything of. But if you look at worldwide group and graded races on the turf over the last 10 years, the proportion of fillies who win these, absolutely massive. All sex group ones with that allowance, especially when you've got a tight group. It's a huge advantage.
Expert eye.
Is a very talented horse. His best efforts have come over 7 furlongs. The question is he going to be as effective at a mile? He should be okay round here, where the demand is more on a turn of speed than it is necessarily on grinding, winding stamina at a mile. So, yeah, if there's a horse with a bit of star quality, it's probably him. Yeah, he's looked explosive in the Jersey. He looked explosive last year in the Vintage Stakes at Goodwood. So if he really brings his A game, he'd be quite a hard horse to beat.
And that style on this course... It happens to play well if you've got that burst.
The stalk and pounce.
Yes, and in fact, and also, you know, because this is not a even though there's a longish stretch, it's still you got to be pretty nimble here, and that's something that in fact Sadler's Joy, Tom Albertrani, is very excited because he thinks this course, he's never run here, Sadler's Joy. Mm. This is a course that is going to suit him a lot better than where we've been seeing him. And
he showed that kick, didn't he, when he won the Sword Dancer. Was it with the Sword Dancer he won last year at Saratoga?
Last year when he beat
Chad Brown's horse, didn't he, in that head-bobbing finish.
People are going to look at him and think that he's really not in form. He hasn't had a great year. It's not true. And I know that Albertrani's excited about him running here because he thinks that the tighter turns and you know, the tighter course is going to be to his liking. And, you know, that's a big aspect. You know, we look at Woodbine and we look at Belmont, and we got these big, you know, these big wide turns, and you need to be a big kind of long strider. If you're a sharp, nimble horse, you'll do well here.
I think that's where a horse like Expert Eyes should come into his own, really. He is a sharp horse. He's a sharp horse with a turn of foot. I know Frankie Dettori is looking forward to riding him. I spoke to him this morning. He's got, you know, three good rides. He's got Azira, Expert Eye, and Enable, the three E's.
The three E's. Look at that. We got a theme already. And, you know, you mentioned Roaring Lion. I got my first look at him today, and he certainly doesn't look like a Kitten's Joy.
In what way?
Well, color, for starters. I mean, just I mean, he's gray, mm-hmm. and he just he's a different animal, and
Let me ask you this: when you looked at him today, did you think, "Wow, that's a horse who's having his ninth run of the year, and he started back in April"? I bet you didn't. He carries his condition remarkably well.
Well, he's compact. Mm-hmm. He's not, you know, he's not a horse that looks like a big strapping horse that might wear down. He not at all.
He's
wearing the blanket. It's a little tough. They got the blankie on them, so you know they're half covered up.
But he's a good deep girth horse, and he seems to have taken his racing extremely well. And I think that's one of the reasons why they've been encouraged to come here, is that he can take a hard fight and come back for a bit more and eat up the next day and trot out sound. And I don't think he does more than he absolutely has to.
So he, on paper, has had a long year. Are there any other Europeans that have had a long year that you think they might be
wearing down?
They're taking a shot at one last run. Or are they, for the most part, coming over here with tremendous intentions?
Well, there aren't. I mean, I know there aren't, all. There aren't many that come in here completely out of form. Put it that way.
Yeah.
They are all coming in with very few exceptions. They're all coming into the meet in really good form. Aidan O'Brien tends to run his horses a bit more than most trainers do at the top level. When you, as I said to somebody earlier, when you've had 110 individual horses running in stakes races, in graded stakes races in the last 12 months, then you know you've got quite a lot of ammunition to fire. I think the next highest number is 60-odd, and that's in Australia. So,
and he's had success doing it.
And people say it's not been a great season for him, but
I love that. I saw a headline.
12 or 13 grade ones, and there's a few more to come, I should think. So
I think it was in the Racing Post. I saw a headline about he's looking forward to a resurgence in 2019.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, oh, what a down year. He only won, 20-something grade ones?
It's pretty remarkable. But there are horses that he's had that have had longish seasons, like Gustav Klimt, and Happily's had quite a few runs. But you couldn't argue that they're coming into this meet not in the best form that they've been in. Then he's got one or two other horses, like Magical, who I think is a very interesting runner wherever she shows up. She's got first preference in the turf, second preference in the filly and mare turf. We've only had three or four runs this year. So, yeah, he's got one or two fresh ones as well. And, of course, as far as he's concerned, probably, though he wouldn't say so publicly, these are all interesting runners, but they're all part of a big sideshow, because for him, there's only one race that is really, really, really important, and we know what that is because he's been training the horse for it all year, Mendelssohn.
Mm-hmm. You have any further thoughts since we were in New York and watched the Jockey Club Gold Cup?
I still maintain it's the best chance of a European winner on dirt in this race that there's been for ages, or a European trained winner, just because you've got two horses in Mendelssohn and Thundersnow, and I know everyone's going to laugh because they both come here to Kentucky and fluff their lines in spectacular fashion before, but we know that they're capable of producing really high class grade one form against this caliber of opposition, so we sort of know where we are with them a little bit more than we do with Roaring Lion. And the equation with Roaring Lion is quite simple: if he translates his turf form to dirt, he'll win.
And as our late friend John Asher always said, he loves a little green in the pedigree, trying the dirt here for the first time. He's always believed that turf horses trying dirt for the first time have done well at Churchill Downs. And I always remember a great quote from the late Charlie Whittingham: when's the best time to try a turf horse on dirt?
The first time. Well, that's the Asher corollary, as we've said for years.
So what is it then about the dirt surface or the dimensions of the track?
It's the clay.
Churchill,
it's the clay content.
So about the clay. About 25 feet below the surface here at Churchill Downs. As you know, we're located, about 10 miles from the Ohio River. There are known as aquifers. About 25 feet below. And I know the Lear brothers, they were here for 40-something years. They always believed that the aquifers down below did something to the clay surface below that's made it such a tremendous, I mean, really, it's a tremendous racing surface. If it rains early in the week, as we said, you know, on Wednesday and Thursday afternoon, you know we're going to have a fast track. Heck, it could pour Friday morning if you wanted to. It'll be fast by the fourth race. Mm-hmm. So it's a tremendous surface. I don't know what it is with turf, but I have seen turf horses do very well. John has said that for a while.
It's the clay, and it, mm-hmm. it's the fact that the hoof sticks more, slides less here than it does on a conventional loose.
So your horse that's coming from turf, it's not such a culture shock for them when they try and find their footing, particularly when they come out of the gate. It's all a mad scramble, and they're not wheel spinning quite as much. Whereas, of course, if it's an off track and it's rained right on the point of the race,
a la 2017 Kentucky Derby,
correct, or a la the 2018 Kentucky Derby,
yep,
you could just stick a line through and say actually those rules don't apply.
Absolutely, because a horse, the horses. There's only one thing that determine their eagerness to run, and that is their footing. They are the one fear they have is falling, because then they're susceptible to their natural environment, the cougar or whatever, mountain lion or whatever, because it takes a long time for a horse to get up. That's their biggest, they're flight animals. That's their biggest fear. So if they don't like the way the footing is, they will not put out. They will not compromise their ability to stand, and that is 100% why here a turf horse has got a little bit more confidence going over this surface, because their hoof doesn't slide like it does on conventional dirt.
You look at the turf horses that have run well from Europe here at Churchill Downs. There's quite a lot of them. Sheikh Albadou had absolutely no credentials to be running on dirt when he won the sprint here at a huge price back in 1988
first year 88
for the late Alex Scott, and he did what he did. Giant's Causeway ran here on the dirt, was narrowly beaten, so you know I'm reasonably encouraged.
There you go. Well, we've got plenty of this to talk about, and we will do a lot of juvenile stuff with you, which we always enjoy. I do want to ask about...
I do a lot of juvenile. I do a lot of juvenile stuff. Not everyone always enjoys it.
Wait till Lafitte. Lafitte gets here. Then the two of you can really go to town.
Especially some of the viewers of last year's Eclipse Awards. Anyway.
Hey now. Good job. Carl Burke,
yes,
I know, is bitterly disappointed about Comedy not getting into the juvenile race.
Yeah,
but Havana Gray,
yes,
who was very much targeted for this, this has been a frustrating race, the turf sprint.
Yeah, he won't mind. He won't mind a bit of cut in the ground.
Okay, because him and Lost Treasure, it feels like the Euros have kind of given up a little bit on this turf sprint in America.
You can't really blame them, though, can you?
If Lamotto,
it's not exactly been a story of
no,
unalloyed success, has it? Trouble is, you've got to think, half of those turf sprints since the inception of the race just about have been run on the downhill track.
Which is unusual.
So you've got to strike that out, because that really is a specialist discipline at 6.5. So
true.
A more regulation 5.5, you should get horses coming here and running well. So Havana Gray's legitimate. He's a legitimate Grade 1 performer. He won a bad Grade 1, admittedly, at the Curra, but he's a good, solid, sound horse. I could see him getting placed.
It's
a question of whether he's quite got the early boot relative to, you know, your Peter Miller types to be able to hold a position is a moot point.
What's Lost Treasure?
Well, exactly. I mean, well, I'll tell you what Lost Treasure is. Lost Treasure is an extremely well-bred horse by Warfront, who's actually a half to Just Wonderful, who is entered in the Philly's Juvenile Turf. Out of a very talented filly who went wrong early in her career called Wading. And Lost Treasure ran off his face, essentially, in the Prix de l'Abbé to get rated high enough to get into this race. At 100-1, finished a fast-finishing fifth, but it was a bit of a mess of a race. And has run twice subsequently. I mean, this is Aidan O'Brien all over. Has run people go, oh, can horses run at the Arc meeting and then run at the Breeders' Cup? This horse had two runs in between. So it looks like they're trying to condition the horse.
Interesting.
For this.
He's going to be a million to one here. He's going to be 60-1.
Pedigree's all right. Performance level maybe falls a tiny bit short, but I don't know. It's a complete unknown. My issue with the horse, just looking at the videos, is that it's a horse who tends to get quite a long way back, and it's not going to. Is any 5.5 furlong race in this country really going to set for a deep closer?
There's been deep closers that have gotten up here.
When you've got horses of a genuine caliber who can sustain speed.
To his point, I want to have speed in an inside draw. I mean, that's no shock.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd say that for most 5/8 of a mile turf sprints, it's no different at 5.5. I want to have early footing and have an inside draw.
We've gotten on early footing here. Day one that just zipped by at Churchill Downs, and we'll get your opinions later in the week.
Absolutely. Sounds great.
All right.
Yeah, absolutely.
What? I know it's not Derby.
I'm already going to butcher the horse's name again, but my big price play...
Moustachery.
Moustachery. I wanted to call him Mooshatry. Moustachery is one of my most intriguing plays, and I have some.
You got to have
hot opinions.
You got to have a juvenile that's in your back pocket.
Yeah, the juvenile is kind of a headliner that may or may not be going off at 3-5. I mean, I think it's all game winner.
All right.
I really do.
What
I think he's...
Anything on the grass? Newspaper of record, maybe?
Newspaper of record, I think, is the most likely winner of the 2 days. And I throw that in the category of the enables. And I love Abel Tasman to bounce back. I don't think Monomoy Girl or Midnight Bazoo are up to...
You don't think the three-year-old filly is very good?
I think they're very good. I think they've had a long year, taxing campaign, and I am willing to completely... I mean, I'm operating off of the assumption that Abel Tasman is going to bounce back. She's just faster. She's a faster girl on the playground.
Filthy run last time, wasn't it? But she was sick.
It was. And I wouldn't mind using Blue Prize underneath.
Mm-hmm.
She loves it here at Churchill. I think she's been underrated. And if you like Blue Prize like I do, you have to use Champagne Problems, who's been separated by a neck to 3/4 of a length, and she might be improving. She has to be 30-1. So I'm going to key a Abel Tasman and Blue Prize Champagne Problems kind of underneath. And then Limousine Liberal and Whitmore, I'll be honest with you, I think the sprint we'll see today with the draw, but... there's a lot of speed. I know we have the defection of XY Jet. There's still a lot of speed in there. I think it might set it up for a closer.
We will join you. What's good?
I'm heading out to Equestricon tomorrow to do the international panel.
Then let's do
at 11. So I may be here a little before then. If you're there, are you there at the conference? You're undecided at the moment. Some point tomorrow or Wednesday would be great.
Nick Luck, everybody. Follow Nick Luck. Follow Derby Media. And they are a difficult act to follow, period. Always tremendous. Tremendous start. Back tomorrow with you 9 o'clock for a lot more of the same, including Mike Welch, who we didn't find today. Well, Mike must be doing his clock of report. But we will thank Neil Howard and Jack Sadler. Paying tribute to Cock Campbell, Aaron Wellman tomorrow, and ideally with Todd together. That would be huge. Declan Carroll, what fun it was. And then Darren and Nick just now. And, of course, Johnny. The draw this afternoon, 4 o'clock, at Breeders' Cup and Facebook Breeders' Cup feed, and it'll be all over Twitter. And I'll send out the links as soon as PPs go up and the like. If you missed anything, replay tomorrow, 6 to 9 here on SiriusXM. Talk to you tomorrow.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on SiriusXM Radio. Don't wait.
with 14 challenging Breeders' Cup races, 5 Friday, November 2nd, and 9 Saturday, November 3rd, you've got to be ready. Kickstart your handicapping mojo with ExpressBet's free Breeders' Cup wager guide, available online at ExpressBet.com beginning Friday, October 26th. Get analysis, selections, price plays, and $100 wagering strategies for every Breeders' Cup race from expert handicappers and broadcasters, plus plenty of stats and trends you won't find anywhere else. XBTV's Jeff Siegel, At the Races radio host Steve Bick, NBC Sports analysis Nick Luck, and multiple Eclipse Award winner Dick Girardi anchor a powerful team of guide experts. NBC Sports analyst Eddie Olchek and retired sportscaster Brent Musburger of VSEN will contribute to a revised guide version available Thursday, November 1st. Go to ExpressBet.com now, open an account, and get the free guide and play Breeders' Cup.
Account wagering is not permitted in all states. National Problem Gambling Support Line, 1-800-522-4700.
There's more good news about Pennsylvania's breeding program. Last year, the number of state-bred live foals rose by nearly 30%. Many other states saw a drop of between 10 and 20%. This says that Pennsylvania truly has North America's fastest-growing and most lucrative breeding program. And unlike some other states, our Racehorse Development Fund can only be used to support Pennsylvania breeding and racing. This is Brian Sanfratello. Please visit us at PABred.com.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.